Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, June 4th, 2026. Major additions to Champaign's student housing market in the works. Projects focused on Green Street in U of I's campus town. A firm founded by three University of Illinois alumni is gearing up to add more than 3,500 beds to Champaign's student housing market by 2031. The total encompasses three different student housing developments, including the new hub Champaign Green Street core spaces announced. The high-rise at 201 East Green Street on the side of a former bank at the southeast corner of Green and 2nd will include 1,577 beds across 490 units. The project broke ground in fall 2025 and is expected to be complete in summer 2028. According to permits on file with the city, the 15-story building will include first-floor retail space, a parking garage on the first floor and mezzanine level, and amenities such as an exterior deck with a swimming pool and hot tub on the 15th floor. CoreSpaces founders Mark Lifshin, Barry Howard, and Brian Nicewander are all U of I alumni who have spent decades working and living in the community, CoreSpaces officials have said. "This place means a lot to us," said Lifshin, who is also CEO. "We've been buying up properties in anticipation for this moment to do something special at the alma mater of so many of our company. We used to joke that we only hire U of I grads because at one point we made up about 80% of our company." Core Spaces entered the local student housing market in 2020 with its development of Hub Champaign, now known as the Dean, company officials said. This was followed by the Hub Champaign Daniel in 2021, which is owned and managed by Core Spaces. The company then acquired multiple properties along Green Street in 2025 and plans to further expand its hub on campus footprint along the iconic Green Street corridor with additional purpose-built student housing developments, officials said. According to Communications Director Kim Lyons, one project that will be located on the east side of 4th and Green Streets, while the other will be across the street from the new high-rise on the southwest corner of 2nd and Green. "The company is aiming to add about 2,000 beds between the two projects," she said. "This scale allows us to reduce our development costs per square foot to much lower than a typical one-off project, helping us pass through lower rents to our residents, which is really important to us," Nicewander said. "We are thankful for the recent State Property Tax Appeal Board's decisions that made this investment possible and allows us to expand supply and help lower price points for students." A permit application that Core Spaces filed last summer envisions a 7-story building at 111 East Green Street, located at the southwest corner of 2nd and Green, with approximately 470 beds across 140 apartments, as well as first-floor retail and a pool deck on the second floor. The Champaign City Council voted in October to approve a cost-share agreement with Core Spaces for a sanitary sewer extension in this area. The city will reimburse the company for creating more capacity than it expects to need for the two projects at 201 and 111 East Green Street, Economic Development Manager T.J. Blakeman said at the time. It's estimated that the reimbursement will total $1.95 million, with these funds coming from the city's portion of the development's property tax. The city has entered into similar agreements with Core Spaces in the past. Partners in Success, 15th V. Dale Cozad Entrepreneurs of the Year. Linda Davis Ballard and Courtney McKay, the mother and daughter team behind Champaign Cornerstone Art Mart, were guests of honor at Wednesday's Parkland College Foundation Entrepreneur of the Year banquet at the iHotel and Illinois Conference Center. The co-owners of the Champaign County's oldest woman-owned business shared the 15th V. Dale Cozad Entrepreneur of the Year Award. E. Wilsey Memorial Baseball Tournament. It's opened my eyes to the good people around us. Father Event's namesake hopes it can become an annual tradition. John Ross Woolsey credits the company community around him with helping his family through a challenging few years. That was on display a year ago when six local youth baseball teams played in the first tournament named for Easton Woolsey, John Ross's son, who was killed in an accident on September 8, 2023. "We live, in my opinion, in the best community you could possibly live in," John Ross said. "And that stretches all the way throughout Champaign County, Central Illinois, from north to south. Ever since when the tragedy happened, I mean, it's opened my eyes to the good people around us, and to the support system we have." John Ross hopes that the Easton Woolsey Memorial Baseball Tournament will become an annual tradition. It will take another step toward becoming that this weekend, when five teams descend upon Royal Field from Friday through Sunday for the second edition of the event. "They really cushioned the blow a ton," John Ross said, "and last year was just another great example of the people that are around us and that community that some people have never even met in my life have come up, and it helps." Nate Massey and Matt McElhoe have stepped up to help organize the tournament since its inception. All three families remain close and have collaborated to coordinate the logistics of hosting a big weekend of baseball. McElhoe remembers returning home to see his son Corbin hanging out with Woolsey and their friends. "When I would come home from work, there'd be five bikes out in front of my house, and his was always one of them," McElhoe said. "Easton was the type of kid. He was the one that would stick up for his friends, and that's the one thing that I always liked about him, and he was honest. You couldn't have picked a better kid for your kids to be friends with. Sports, particularly baseball, wrestling, and football, were a big part of Easton's life, with friends on teams throughout the area. We've got a good group of local teams, and they all knew Easton," Massey said. "A lot of them played football with him or wrestled with him, and it means something to all of them, coaches, players, fans, everybody. John Ross credits wrestling with helping him grow as a person while he passed along his passion for football down to his son. Baseball has long held special meaning for the Woolsey family. John Ross and his wife, Brooke, met while he played for the Royal Giants of the Eastern Illinois Baseball League. It doesn't surprise McElhoe that baseball has helped the healing process in the years since Easton, then a fourth grader at Prairie View Ogden Elementary School, passed away at the age of 9. Our community is pretty much baseball-oriented," McElhoe said. "I think if you would walk into Freeman Tavern and look on the walls, you're going to see the baseball field and things like that. It's good to get the kids out there, and it's also good that we're doing it for a good cause." Royal Field was decked with green during the 2025 event, and Easton's favorite color figures to be prominent again this weekend. The winning team will again receive green trophy bats. Massey's team won the crown in 2025, and he has his displayed in his shed. While Massey mentioned the possibility of again painting Easton's number 2 into the outfield grass, "We played Royal on Friday night last year, and they mentioned that was probably the biggest crowd they've ever played in front of," Massey said. "There were a lot of people there. Wooden bats will be used during this year's tournament. Each team will receive 2 dinger bats to use throughout the weekend. I'm a big fan of the purity of the game, and there's nothing better than the sound of a wooden bat," John Ross said. Sydney Dairy Barn, Smithburger, and Kona Ice will be on hand this weekend, while Royal Giants players will be selling pork chops and hot dogs. Last year's event raised funding for scholarships and field improvements, according to Massey. "It was just a good community event," Massey said. "We had a lot of people come and support it, and we have a lot of volunteers and a lot of sponsors, and it kind of just brought the community all together." John Ross is looking forward to more of the same this weekend, which begins on Friday at 6 p.m. with a contest between the St. Joseph Bandits 1-1U team and the Royal Junior Giants 1-1U squad. The St. Joseph Ogden Spartans 12U team will face the Royal Junior Giants 12U team later that evening, with the Bandits, Giants, Rantoul, Rush, and Junior Jaguars set to compete on Saturday in advance of the final round on Sunday. "It's amazing to see communities come together like that," John Ross It sucks that it's the way it is, but I can't say enough about it. Teacher of the Week, Gary L. Pierce, reading interventionist Dr. Howard Elementary Champaign, laying a foundation for fluent readers. Gary L. Pierce's teaching career began in South Carolina, where she was placed as part of Teach for America. After her third year on the job, in which she won the school's Teacher of the Year award, the Springfield native returned to her home state to pursue her Ph.D. at the University of Illinois while continuing to teach. After spending time at Urbana's Wiley Elementary and Champaign's Robeson Elementary, she's now a reading interventionist at Dr. Howard Elementary in Unit 4. I find my work important because, as an interventionist, I am providing direct instruction to the students that need it the most. Reading is the foundation of all learning, so working with students to strengthen and develop their reading skills is so fulfilling to me. I became a teacher because I was called to be one. My mom had a huge influence on my calling because growing up, I watched her teach and truly care about the community she taught in, her students, and their families. My favorite or most unique lesson that I teach is called The Case of the Missing Pencil Sharpener. It's a lesson I came up with to teach students about making inferences. It's really interactive because I actually include suspects from the school and narratives on why they potentially could have taken the sharpener. I also am so dramatic about someone talking in the classroom, pencil sharpening, and students love my theatrics in solving the mystery. I'd say this year, transitioning as an interventionist, I really liked the readers' theater I organized. I had my reading groups read their plays to different classrooms in the school to practice their fluency. The students were so excited, and other teachers and their students were extremely supportive, too. My most fulfilling moments on the job are when a not-so-confident reader becomes a confident reader. Sometimes, all a student needs is a patient teacher and the safe space to practice, to then feel more comfortable reading out loud and reading in general. It makes me extremely happy when a student tests out of intervention. I keep my students engaged by getting to know them as individuals. I am always checking in with them and asking about their hobbies and extracurricular activities. I show students that I care about them and their life outside of school, and I think that's why students of all ages truly enjoy learning from me. Something else I'm passionate about is finding books in red velvet form. I have a list on my phone of red velvet books I have and haven't tried. I have found many yummy red velvet treats, such as red velvet donut, snow cone, and cheesecake. I haven't found a red velvet churro or funnel cake, and many others on my list. So if you know where I need to go to try, let me know. My favorite teacher and subject to study in school was, that's hard. I was a big English language arts and science girl. My favorite English language arts teacher was Mr. E. at Calvary Elementary in Springfield. He always allowed me to check out multiple books in third grade because of my love for reading. He also encouraged me as a writer by giving clear and positive feedback. My favorite science teacher was Mrs. Katzmark at Little Flower School in Springfield. She kept learning fun and really pushed me my eighth grade year to embrace my love for science. She volunteer and told me to present my science fair project at a state level competition. If I weren't a teacher, I would be a podiatrist for sure. Top of the morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. As a student, Jim Wood had little interest in the Civil War, but after a stop at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania during a family vacation in the early 1980s, he became hooked. "I can't hear or learn enough about it," said Wood, 80, who lives just south of Sydney. Jim's later in life interest led him to buying a Civil War era cannon that for the past 30 years he demonstrates when asked, including ceremonies in schools. Most recently, he fired four booming symbolic shots during Sydney American Legion Post 433's Memorial Day service at Mount Hope Cemetery. "That meant very much to me," he said. "Since I didn't serve, this is the least I can do." Interested in having Jim and his cannon visit for a free-of-charge demonstration? Call 217-722-0262. Michael's Records and Radio column, another dive into the area's radio music markets. I open today's column with our quiz question. From 1955 until today, who are the four artists who have charted at least four different albums into the top 10 on the Billboard album chart simultaneously in the same week? Fred Delcroman asked me a recurring question I field. My wife has an account with Amazon, so we have Alexa to help us queue up the music we want to listen to. Tonight, I requested music by Fleetwood Mac. We ended up listening to tracks from their album Rumors. I happen to have a CD of that album, and I have heard songs from it on many occasions. However, listening to what Alexa served up, it struck me that the music was just off a little. Maybe it was the low quality of the speakers through which the music was playing, but the tonal quality did not seem right. My question to you is, what Alexa plays, not the original soundtrack? Is it maybe just an AI-generated version, perhaps to avoid copyright issues? I am certainly no music expert, so my ears have been deceiving me, but I thought I would ask if you had any insight as to what may have been happening. Don't hesitate to just tell me I was imagining things. Well, Fred, no, you are not imagining things. What has happened is time has elapsed since the song's initial recording. Many, many songs have been remastered and or remixed to adapt to different platforms like CDs and streaming. Thus, floating around the big, wide, wonderful world of the Internet, Alexa may have 5, 6, 7, 8 or more mixes to choose from. I am stickler for presenting music on the radio in 2026 via its initial radio presentation when a song was first released. Sadly, as a radio geek, I can within a few seconds recall if a song presented is the original radio mix release or a remix remaster. Almost a sixth sense. I am a real purist on songs, since a radio mix is the first version someone is exposed to. This is one of the reasons why original vinyl albums and 45s continue to grow in sales volume. Both new pressings and original personal albums that have acquired some scratches down through the years. I was humbled by the huge response to the last two columns regarding if you programmed a radio station. Long-time morning show listener Roger Cooley was fascinated by my mention of KRTH and WCBS FM being heritage radio stations with essentially, although updated, the same formats for over a half century. He wanted to know how many stations would fall in that half century category in Illinois. Some months back, we talked about WLRW Champaign, WBNQ Bloomington, WDNL Danville, and WDBR Springfield being contemporary music stations that had their roots in the 70s. This sent me down a fun rabbit hole researching commercial radio music formats market by market. Let's look at the results. Champaign-Urbana. Besides WLRW, WPGU has played some form of rock since the 60s. Decatur, WDZQ, has played country since the 70s. Springfield, besides WDBR, WFMB has been country since the 70s. Peoria, WXCL-AM, began as country in the 60s. The brand continues today on WXCL-FM. WWCT call letters have survived a bunch of different frequency changes over the last 50 years. A bunch of different variations of rock. Galesburg, WAAG, has played country since the 70s. Carbondale, WCIL-FM, has been a top 40 hit music station since the 70s. Quincy, KGRC, has played some variation of contemporary top 40 since signing on in 1968. Terre Haute, Indiana, WTHI-AM, was country in the 70s. The brand was moved to FM in the early 80s, where it continues as country today. Quad Cities, WXLP, has played some form of album rock since hitting the air in 1978. Rockford, WROK-AM, was top 40 through most of the 70s when they began their transition to adult contemporary. Sister station WZOK-FM received many of the contemporary assets of WROK. So loosely, the two OK stations have been some form of top 40 rock since the early 70s. Chicago WXRT has, since 1972, been a legendary rock station that has gracefully evolved to embrace new listeners while respecting their longtime listeners. WBBM-FM was an adult rock station from 1966 until 1982, when it went full top 40. Since the 90s, it has made a number of pivots around a rhythmic-based contemporary hip-hop and top 40. WGCI-FM began as a disco station in 1975, evolving into an Urbana R&B hip-hop mix powerhouse. WVAZ-FM began as WBMX in 1974. The Black music experience. It switched to urban adult contemporary as V103 in 1988. St. Louis, since the summer of 1967, KSHE has been the St. Louis rock station, beginning in 1968. WILAM went country. WILFM picked up the format in the early 70s and has been in the format ever since. KYKY has been some form of contemporary music since its 1972 sign-on as KSLQ. Thanks, Roger, for inspiring me to do this deep dive. My guess, I have probably left off a couple of stations. Please let me know. Got column ideas? I'd love to hear them. Legislature okays bill limiting how social media companies target feeds to children. Lawmakers on the final day of the General Assembly passed a bill to regulate how minors interact with social media and other online platforms to make them less addictive. The goal of House Bill 5511, the Children's Online Social Media Safety Act, is to prevent those under the age of 18 from being exposed to harmful content and addictive features by requiring social media companies to confirm a user's age through the device's operating system. The bill doesn't prevent children from downloading or using social media apps. During device setup, parents would set the child's age, which would adjust certain design features in apps such as algorithmic feeds, the visibility of the child's profile, and what media can be shown to them. The bill passed the Senate unanimously on Monday by a vote of 57-0. It passed the House a second time on Monday by a vote of 113-0. Governor J.B. Pritzker, who proposed the bill during his February budget address, celebrated its passage Monday and said he would sign it. "I'm proud the Illinois General Assembly passed the Children's Online Social Media Safety Act, marking an important milestone in our efforts to improve kids' safety and privacy online, mitigate the harmful effects of social media on mental and physical health, and prevent financial scamming," Pritzker said. Efforts to pass some kind of measure in Illinois have been ongoing for a few years. The legislation is about recognizing a simple reality. Children are not miniature adults, said State Senator Willie Preston, Democrat Chicago, the bill's sponsor. These platforms invest billions of dollars into capturing attention, maximizing engagement, and keeping users online for as long as possible. When that system is directed at developing minds, the consequences will be and have proven to be devastating and sadly irreversible. The bill previously passed the House in April with a bipartisan vote of 82-27. The Senate version mainly increased privacy protectors for minors and altered definitions to target the most harmful platforms. While this legislation is not perfect, lawmakers cannot continue waiting for the perfect solution while technology continues to evolve around us, said State Senator Sue Resin, Republican Morris. She helped work on some of the bill's language and has advocated for social media protections for youth for years. The bill prohibits social media companies from using a minor's viewing history or data stored on the device to determine what shows up on their feeds. Instead, feeds for minors will only be allowed to show information the user requested or searched for or was posted by a creator the user follows. Youths will also be able to see media in a direct private message. Under the bill, platforms could be required to establish some default privacy settings for minors, shield their precise location, and limit digital currency transactions. Social sites and apps would also be prohibited from sending notifications between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m. The Illinois General Illinois Attorney General's office would enforce the law, which would take effect in 2028. Violators will be liable for fines up to $2,500 for each child for unintentional violations and up to $7,500 per child for intentional violations. Lobbyists for tech companies raised concerns that the bill may violate the First Amendment and warned that it will likely face lawsuits, but the governor's office said in a Saturday committee that the bill's language is modeled after legislation in other states that have survived court challenges. Talks resume on bill to fund immigration agencies. Likely amendment would ban Trump's $1.8 billion settlement fund. The Republican-led Senate is moving forward with legislation to fund immigration enforcement agencies after forcing the Trump administration to say it will drop its settlement fund for political allies and stripping a separate proposal for White House security from the bill. The Senate voted 53-46 on Wednesday to begin debate on the roughly $70 billion to fund U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the Border Patrol. The legislation was delayed for weeks as Republican senators navigated the various obstacles to passage created by President Donald Trump and the White House, but they are now moving quickly to pass it after paring it back to its original form. Right now, the goal is to get the base bill across the finish line, said Senate Majority Leader John Tooney, Republican, South Dakota. Still, Republicans will need to fix enough votes to beat back multiple amendments that Democrats and some Republicans say they will offer to permanently ban Trump's $1.776 billion settlement fund. After fierce Republican pushback, Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche told House lawmakers at a hearing Tuesday that we are not moving forward with the fund, period. But shortly after the Senate voted to move forward with the bill Wednesday, Trump repeatedly defended the settlement in response to the reporters' questions at the White House. When asked directly whether the fund is dead or just on hold, Trump responded, "I'd have to ask the lawyers, I don't know." "I love it," Trump said of the settlement, "and I think it's so important." Republicans are using a process called budget reconciliation that enables them to pass the bill without any Democratic votes, but that they must first wade through a long series of amendment votes that could pose problems. That process is expected to start today. Republicans said they felt reassured by Blanche's promises to scrap the fund, part of a settlement resolving Trump's lawsuit against the IRS over the leak of his tax returns. Train derails after hitting truck in Iowa, killing one. A train struck a semi-trailer Wednesday in eastern Iowa, killing one person and injuring another, authorities said. The crash occurred at the crossing of a state highway and the Iowa Interstate Railroad in a rural area about 70 miles east of Des Moines, according to Poweshiek County Sheriff Matt Mashman. One person in the semi-trailer died, and another was transported with serious injuries, Mashman said in a statement. 17 train cars and two power engines derailed after the crash and caused significant damage to the railroad, he said. Images of the scene showed a massive heap of rail cars with billowing smoke. No hazardous material was spilled, according to Iowa State Patrol spokesman Sergeant Alex Dinkla. This has been Mary Moreland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, June 4th, 2026. Please stay tuned for Part 2.